So this talk is part of a longer series that we're calling hashtag public feminisms, and in which we've invited feminist scholars to reflect on the contemporary moment in Indian feminisms. So earlier in the series, we hosted Professor Ashwini Tambe from the University of Maryland, who spoke about dissonances between some forms of academic feminism and the more public feminism of the hashtag MeToo campaign. We then hosted Professor Radhika Govinda of the University of Edinburgh, who offered an overview of contemporary media-based feminisms of India. So we're now delighted to have V. Geeta to give the third talk in this series today. It's also part of the Changing India series sponsored by the Pratiksha Trust, in which we've invited artists, academics, and public intellectuals to reflect on some of the most pressing issues of our times. V. Geeta is a well-known feminist writer, scholar, translator, editor, and activist based in Chennai. She's long been involved with the women's movement and has written widely on questions of caste, education, and sexual violence. Many of us here at NIAS had read her recent responses to contemporary moments in Indian feminism, and we were very keen to have her here with us sharing her thoughts more broadly. So we're delighted to welcome Geeta today to give a talk titled Speaking of Assault, Expressions and Their Histories. Welcome, Geeta.
Thank you, Hemangini, for inviting me here, and thanks for coming. Without much ado, I'll start right away. I want to start by referencing two incidents in my own home state of Tamil Nadu, which are sort of congruent with some of the issues that nationwide we've been addressing in the wake of the hashtag MeToo campaign and also in the wake of issues around sexuality in general. One of which has to do with a university in Madurai city where a woman professor has been allegedly involved in getting young girls lured into a transactional sex network. And she's currently facing a prosecution. And this incident came to light at almost the same time as the Raya Sarkar's list that was put online in 2017. Interestingly, this has not made it to the national news, but I think it shares a set of common features with some of the concerns raised by students about universities, education, gender, sexuality, and what is the nature of the crisis that our universities are facing, apart from the larger political crisis that all of us are plunged into. So I think I wanted to bring that up because why is it that in a state like Tamil Nadu, which has had a long history of dealing with issues of caste and gender, that something like this incident did not incite widespread public outrage or debate and so on, and it was not even seen as something germane that people should be picking up and speaking about? What makes it possible for a professor to allegedly lure students into offering sexual favors to people in the university and in the broader educational bureaucracy? Now, what does this mean? So what is this ease with which transactional sex becomes a part of university life? So this is one question that sort of came to my mind. The second incident is far more recent. And again, I don't know if you know about it or not, but this has to do with what is called the Pollachi incident. I'm sure some of you have heard of it, where videos have been uploaded of women who have been, again, the word that is often used is lured into meeting young men who then threaten to assault them and who force themselves on these women, have this filmed and blackmail them and so on. So this is also very interesting because from what we know, and we don't know all that much, but from what we know, some of these men are known to these women, either because they were in school together or in college together and so on. And predictably, the outrage has been not so much about what has happened, but why did these women go and do what they did? Why did they agree to a blind date? Why did they agree to meet these men? And so this has been the general commonsensical response. And again, what is interesting is the questions that one ought to ask are not being asked. Basically about what has changed in the lives of women, not just in urban metropolitan areas, but in small towns or in extended peri-urban areas, that they are not averse to seeking sexual pleasure and that they do not mind going on blind dates. So how does one understand this, and do we have the discursive protocols to even start talking about some of these things in a public cultural sense. So these two incidents, I think, are important for me to sort of keep in mind when, as I go ahead to address other issues, because they point to certain kinds of shifts in the way that we have come to address the entire domain of sexuality, not from the point of view of political interventions, but from the way in which social behavior perhaps has been transformed, and we perhaps don't know enough about this. And I want to place this within two other larger contexts, some of which are more familiar to you perhaps than this. One is, of course, the kind of queering of the discourses around sexuality and sexual experiences, which has sort of been on the horizon for the last decade and more, with the increasing visibility of queer voices and faces and activism in public life. And the other is the extreme tension that has emerged in parts of India, particularly in southern India, over what are known as these intercaste marriages or intercaste relationships, often resulting in extremely punitive action leading to violence and death. So these two are larger factors or larger frames within which we might want to sort of think about shifts in our own understanding of sexuality itself. And what kind of conversations have they made possible, and what kind of conversations are still not possible in a public sense? So keeping these features in mind, I want to step back and take a look at how in the women's movements across India since the late 1960s, women's groups have addressed the question of sexual violence. And I think this recounting of this history is a useful heuristic exercise, not because I think that the present can only be seen in terms of a continuity of the past or with a profound discontinuity. But I do think history serves often a very pedagogic purpose as well. So to identify what is specific about our own contemporary moment, and to sort of ask ourselves if we are perhaps, are we or are we not repeating some of these kinds of expressions and responses we've had in the past? Or are we doing something else that's new? What has changed? What has not changed? And I think this is a useful exercise in that sense. Unfortunately, this gets coded in terms of a generational divide, which I'm not sure is a very purposive or useful way of looking at it. It might be more fruitful to think of how over swaths of time, those who define themselves as feminists or those who are part of the various women's movements in this country have engaged with sexual violence, and how might we place the current moment in the expansive backdrop of that larger history. So that's why I want to do this historical thing and then come back to some of the issues that I started out with. How might we indeed talk about sexuality, sexual experiences, changing sexual cultures in the present moment? Because I don't know one can talk of Me Too hashtag only in terms of the law or rights. I think it also is sort of calling out for some understanding of, you know, what a friend in a very expansive moment called a sexual revolution. I don't know if it qualifies to be called as such, but, you know, I think she was sort of very concerned that there is something that's changing and we are not able to capture that change. So whether revolution or not, we can all decide later, but I do think that there are shifts, and how might these shifts be understood in a slightly longer durée of historical developments. So what I'm going to start with is therefore to look at some of the ways in which feminists and women's groups have responded to the question of sexual violence. And I, by no means is this an exhaustive account of all that has been said and done since the 60s. Neither is it sort of broad enough to cover things across the vast expanse of this country. But I'm working also from a fairly limited archive, which is material available, say, in the Manushi archives. Manushi has been published since 1979, and it is a fairly faithful record of all the debates of the first 10 years. So what do those archives tell us about the nature of the debates around sexual violence during that period in time? I've also had occasion to look at conversations amongst feminists, listen to some of them, and also things that have been put up on the Zuban archive about women's reminiscences of their own role in the women's movements. So putting some of these things together and also thinking through my own sort of presence in these movements since the 80s, I've tried to come up with what appears to be the shape of an argument. And I'm sure there are enough people here who can add to it and tell me if I've got something wrong or if my memory is sort of playing tricks. So let me start with a very broad historical thing, because contrary to how we think of the women's movements today, we think of it largely in terms of something called women's movements which is not linked to anything else. But clearly the decade of the 1970s was not experienced as such by all those who then went on to found women's movements or women's groups or who set up reading groups or did a bunch of very diverse things around the women's question. So therefore I think it's important to place it in the context of very broad changes that were perceived to have taken place from the second decade of independence. And so I think by the decade of the 60s, and most contemporary historians would agree with this, nation building appeared an enterprise in retreat. Two unpleasant wars, policies that sought to build public industry and enterprises, but which also dispossessed thousands of people, class and caste contradictions, which sharpened as dominant and powerful communities took advantage of India's centralized planning initiatives, and amidst all of this, a growing and restive population of disaffected workers and intellectuals. So you find all these causes coming together to constellate into certain moments of resistance and rebellion in the late 1960s and in the early 1970s. We all know by the mid-60s and after, armed left resistance had resurfaced in India. We forget that there was armed left resistance in the 40s and well into the early 50s in different parts of India, but it resurfaced in the late 1960s. But there was also other forms of resistance, militant trade unionism, for example, peasant anger, the beginnings of all the farmers' movements at that time. So all of these gathered momentum as the 60s gave way to the 70s, and it's important for us to perhaps recognize that many of those we associate with the Indian women's movements or with Indian feminisms emerged out of these struggles, and that they were concerned with these very broad, expansive issues as they debated the women's question in different parts of India. They did not separate the women's question from these various other contexts and movements of which some of them were a part or with which they were engaged in different ways. So that's, I think, important. And I think one of the earliest records we have of this is Gay Lomvet, who visits India in 1971 to sort of capture the beginnings of a nascent women's movement, as she calls it. She is deputed by the Bulletin of Concerned Asian Scholars to write up on this emergent women's movement, and she comes here and she spends a fair amount of time in Maharashtra, in Marathwada, in fact. And then she writes that fascinating book which many of us have forgotten, Chains of Servitude, which captures something very unique in Maharashtra towards the early 1970s. And there, in that book, she notes how the resentment that she found amongst women was very widespread and very diverse. Expressions of this resentment was very widespread and very diverse. So she said that, she notes that you find women asking questions about rights to land, rights to common resources, against domestic violence, against wife beating, alcoholism, even as they are parts of various resisting movements. So you have women who are part of the Shada movement in Maharashtra. You have women who are part of peasant movements in Maharashtra again. Those who are part of an emergent new trade unionism in Bombay city. So all of them are asking questions about the status of women, even as they are part of these various groups. And we're talking about the 1970s. And what is interesting is, and she quotes from many of them, she's done interviews with a bunch of people there, and she says their sense of injustice, their sense of wrong that they experienced was not only on account of these broader issues which shaped their everyday lives and which also shaped their own responses to their lives as women, but short through all of this was a very definite and clear-cut sense of sexual injustice, that they were experiencing something as women, as belonging to a certain gender location and sex location in this country, which was distinctive, which cannot be reduced to these other kinds of exploitation and oppression that they were at the same time going through. Not that it was delinked from those, but it could not be assimilated entirely to those experiences either. And I think Gail captures that very well for us in one of the interviews she does with a Dalit agricultural worker in Bead district, where there's apparently at that time there was a history of many of the young girls from that district being sold into Bombay's sex trade. So she sort of brings up this question, which obviously nobody wants to talk about. And one of the women that she speaks to says, and this I quote from the book, buy freedom for our men, give them land and only land. It is these green fields which will contain our girls, nothing else can. So this sort of connection that this agricultural worker, this Dalit woman could make between sexual enslavement and economic enslavement, this is a theme that is pursued in the early 70s by different groups of women across the country, very vividly in some places, especially the Progressive Organization of Women in Hyderabad, who set up the group in 1974. And well, of course, the immediate discourse available to anyone who's talking about sexual and economic exploitation is, of course, Marxism. And while they retain the broader terms of argument from the Marxist approach to understanding these concerns, you also find other issues leaking in, basically, that this template does not cover the range of experiences that they wish to address and they wish to understand. And a lot of that had to do with interpersonal intimacies gone wrong. It had to do with the absolute loneliness of having to do backbreaking labor outside the house and to come back home and do domestic labor and childcare. So it sort of traverses an entire range of experiences that we would pack into what we call the sphere of reproduction, but which is experienced by these women as something that flows from a personal sense of being wronged. So that's what you get when you read through some of those interviews that are there in Gail's book. And this is one set of developments. The other is, Gail also interviews Dalit women and Bahujan women organizing in Marathwada. And this is, as you know, some of you might know, is a decade of Dalit assertion and resistance with the founding of the Dalit Panthers in Bombay. And also the Namantar movement, the renaming of Marathwada University as Baba Saheb Ambedkar University. And so there was this Maila Samata Sainik Dal which had emerged and which referenced an entire different set of arguments to understand women's oppression. Not only in terms of economic exploitation, not only in terms of this great disquiet within the reproductive sphere, but also in the terms of what the Hindu religion does to you. So rehearsing the arguments from the Ambedkarite movement during this period, you have the Mahila Samata Sainik Dal putting out pamphlets and flyers which speak of how the Hindu religion basically demeans all women and connecting that sense of low self-worth and casual misogyny with the caste system and with Hinduism. So that's the broader template within which they work. But again, what's very interesting is while they say the system demeans women and lower caste men, particularly Dalit men, they also have to account for the fact that women experience this differently. So it's almost as if any kind of theoretical model that you have, whether it's the Ambedkarite model, which Ambedkarite feminists try to work with, or the Marxist model which socialist feminists try to work with, they yet feel the need to bring in to focus another sort of theoretical gesture. And the Ambedkarite feminists say it fairly clearly because after sort of referencing the way in which caste works along with gender to both demean working class Bahujan Dalit men and Bahujan Dalit women, then they go on to say that there is something called the male caste, they say. They use the word caste. I don't know what the Marathi equivalent would have been, but it translates as male caste. And their manifesto says that their fight for equality is not only for equality with the poor, with Dalits and Adivasis, but they also want to take on the male caste, which would mark women as chaste or unchaste and viewed women as mere objects of pleasure. So there is this great unease about being sexually subordinated. And how does one make sense of sexual subordination? This is something that you find people grappling with words and concepts and ideas. And I think what's important also for us to recognize, and this might be something you can connect with some of your earlier initiatives on this campus, the question of language and caste and gender. Because the POW manifesto, the Maila Samata Sainik Dal manifesto, they're all written in the vernacular as well, in Marathi and in Telugu, apart from being put out in English. And there's also a search for words in the vernacular, a search for concepts to house experiences which have never been housed in these words before. How does one therefore talk about these experiences? What is the vocabulary that you will draw upon? What are the equivalents that you can produce in your own language for concepts learnt from the English language? Will mere translation do, or should you sort of rebuild your own linguistic resources in a very fundamental way? And here again, many of us would remember how we had to fight very hard, at least in Tamil Nadu we had to, about the usual word for rape. which is basically loss of chastity. And to get that replaced with a word that suggested violence, it took a decade before that found its way into public discourse, into All India Radio broadcasts, or into newspapers and so on. So the question of language was also very important at this time. How do you talk about sexual violence in the vernacular? And I think this is both an empirical question as well as a conceptual question, because what is the feminist register that existed in any language at this point in time? Because the women's question had been part of the early nationalist movement as well. It had been part of socialist struggles as well, and with the anti-caste struggles. So what distinctive political vocabulary had these movements initiated that we could draw upon or could not draw upon? So these were also sort of part of how we had to sort of grapple with the question of sexual subordination. And it is from this extremely sort of inchoate context where you couldn't really anticipate where all of this would go, that one has to understand the women's movement's engagement with sexual violence. Because in retrospect, everything appears very clean, that everybody knew all the answers, that there were these set of people, they belonged to these caste and class locations, they addressed only these issues and not those issues, none of which was clean. It's very clear from the archive and from people's memories and from their own experiences that everybody was grappling with the very difficult and messy nature of our social realities and how to make sense of those realities in terms of women's subordination, particularly sexual subordination and sexual violence. And I think that is something, it's a very good place to start with, because you see how literally women's movements worked their way through this inchoate mess through the 80s. And that working through is fairly contested. It is difficult. It is full of quarrels. It is full of positions that have to be defended or positions that have to be rethought. So there's nothing given as such. And in Manushi, you see much of that. So what you see initially, of course, is what is immediately available to people writing in English is the language of the Anglo-American second wave of feminism. The whole sexual oppression of women sort of thing, which you have from Kate Millett and with Shulamith Firestone Smith, and the whole generation of 1970s feminists. So that is a language that is available right away. But it's very clear from the early articles in Manushi that you can't use that language beyond a point, because you have to account for caste, you have to account for a very distinctive peasant culture, you have to account for very weighted regional differences. I mean, to even say the word regional differences makes no sense, because these are differences that are historical and they point to several trajectories of historical change in this subcontinent. So it's not that you have a national story, which is one story, and then there are regional variations. There are different historical stories here, and you cannot sort of extrapolate from one to render it a national story. So that's what you get in the early days of Manushi, because Manushi also had a column where you could write in from your own context. And there were all these letters from different parts of India, and they reference very, very diverse realities. So that's also quite interesting in terms of how was one to make sense of all of this. But as I said, the language of Anglo-American second wave feminism provided a kind of guide, let us say. And with all such guides, it can only be of heuristic value. It cannot really reflect all the concerns that we had to address in our own context. But this is what Manushi then says. The second editorial, March-April 1979, and this is what it says, that it's talking about sexual assault, and here you know the context. Those of you who are familiar with how Indian women's movement started talking about rape, the Mathura rape case and the Ramiza B case are usually referenced as important cases, 1972 Mathura, 1978 Ramiza B in Hyderabad. So the Manushi editorial is obviously in the context of failed justice in both cases. But what goes on to say that what does sexual assault mean in all cases, and they mean Ramiza B, they mean Mathura, and they mean a slew of cases of assault of women workers in Bombay City in the construction industry. They also are referencing attacks against Dalit and Bahujan women during the Marathwada violence. Now, these are aspects of a history we have forgotten. So Vibhuti Patel, for example, has a long letter where she says she's part of a fact-finding team that's gone to Marathwada to take note of all the attacks against Dalit women. So basically, people were engaged at several levels and in different geographies and in the context of very different movements when they encounter sexual assault. So how does one make sense of sexual assault in these very different contexts? So what Manushi does is it takes recourse to the generalized language of the second wave, and it says, The attitude that we see is an attitude which denies us our humanity, which reduces us to mere objects, mere bodies to be used or abused, end quote. And what does sexual assault do? Why is it sort of deployed? Quote, to humiliate and terrify us, to destroy our sense of self, end quote. And then, quote again, sexual violence is a conscious process of intimidation to keep women oppressed and in a permanent state of fear. So this is Manushi's second editorial, where it's trying to make sense of these very diverse realities. And then what you see in subsequent issues is a range of writing on sexual assault, much of which is empirical, devoted to particular instances of violence that take place, but also an attempt to make sense of it. Is this something because of our peasant feudal cultures, as the term was used in those days? Is it because of a very ingrained misogyny due to Hinduism and the caste system? Can it be due to certain kinds of changes that have been brought in by the Green Revolution? If you look at Punjab, for example, or East Tanjavur. So you see them going off in various directions trying to make sense of what was sort of appeared suddenly like an epidemic, like sexual violence was everywhere. So trying to make sense of that, whether in the context of specific regional histories, broader issues to do with nation building and development, or to do with a generalized, misogynistic, patriarchal culture. How does one sort of, does one exclude the other therefore? Or should they all be included within a very broad critique of patriarchy? So these are some of the issues that you see in Manushi. And then I think one of the things that they do very effectively is to call attention to what happens right under our noses and which we may not take as important. And the kinds of things that you see is harassment of women students by male teachers, women employees by their supervisors on streets, routine misogyny of acquaintances. All of these are part of the letters to the editor section. And it's like people can't stop writing. There's just so much information that's being put out there. So what is interesting in all of this is that, of course, these long studies of particular instances. So, for example, you have Sudesh Ved of PUDR. Sudesh Ved was not part of Saheli, I think. She was part of PUDR, doing this very long essay on the Raitu Kuli Sangha of Telangana, which was a part of the emergent People's War group at that time. And she has a fantastic ethnographic study of Dalit women's fight for land, and the voices of these very powerful, strong Dalit women who are fighting on two fronts against the landlord system in Telangana, as well as their desire to have land registered in their names as well, not just in the names of their husbands. So what you get are voices of Bahujan Dalit women, but in the context of other people's narratives. You don't have them directly writing or speaking in these forums. They may have written and spoken in other forums, but not in the forums that eventually become the archive of the women's movements. They may even have been recorded in studies by particular women's groups across the country. But what eventually came to constitute the feminist archive does not mark these differences. That there was an understanding that caste and class and region are very central to the kinds of subordination, sexual and otherwise, that women face, to the kind of sexual violence they experience. And there's an attempt to capture those diverse voices. But then none of these find their way into a national register of feminism. Now that is a very interesting question. Why did that happen? Part of it is language, I think. I think the struggles within the vernaculars in terms of writing about feminism or writing about issues to do with the women's question, that must be placed within a very different historical lineage than the struggle to sort of create a national register to do with feminism. The struggle to create a national register comes out of the attempts of women's groups across India to come together and form a distinctive feminist voice, what eventually came to be called the autonomous women's movements, not linked to political parties or to other movements. Whereas struggles in very specific particular contexts could not so easily divorce themselves from the support or opposition of other movements on the ground, whether it's a Dalit movement, whether it's the Dravidian movement, whether it's the Lohia socialists, whether it's the JP movement. So you see that there is that tension between working these things in a local context and translating the lessons of those struggles into the English language. And with translation comes abstraction. And I use the word translation in a very broad sense, that you are trying to translate these realities into a knowable, visible register, which is there in the English language, which draws on the language of Anglo-American feminism, on radical social science writing, but which then once it emerges and starts doing its stuff, does not get back to the vernacular. And that two-way traffic ceases. It may exist in the writings of or the reports of women's groups, but not in the conversations that eventually become the feminist national conversation. So that's something that you see with respect to assault, because all the rich fine-grained studies that are done, the rich arguments at local levels, get converted into a generalized argument which finds its most fitful expression in matters of the law. So, and that of course is something that is dictated by the circumstances in which the Mathura rape case came to be handled and the letter that Upendra Bakshi and others wrote to the Chief Justice at that time, that the law on rape has to be amended. And that then becomes a singular context in which all conversations about sexual violence coalesce, which I think is both productive and limiting. It's productive in that it allows for other people to be part of this conversation. Because the law is also sanitizing. I mean, it sort of makes it a crime which can then be handled by the courts, which can be handled by a rational procedure. And that makes it easy for people to engage with it in the public context. Whereas if you had to engage with the kinds of conversations women were having with each other, then you would have to disturb very accepted notions of the intimate, of the sexually appropriate, of the conjugal, of domesticity. And I think women's groups, the richness of our debates never got translated into the kinds of public statements we made. I don't think the confidence with which we said anything in public captured the 100 hesitancies and ambiguities in our own conversations. And that's also something we need to think about, I think, and ask how might what might make this available without coming across as completely relativistic in all counts. It's not that we were relativistic, but there were tough conversations to have. And I think one of those conversations, which I think is very important to understand the current moment, had to do with our relationship with intimate political others. Our relationship with intimate others in the family we could speak of. We could speak of domestic violence, we could speak of incest, we could speak of children being abused in the family circumstances, but we could never find words to talk of comrades abusing us. We could never find words to talk about political movements which are given over to freedom and justice, not being sensitive to the gender question. That was a very tough conversation. And if you look back, you find that the Naxalite movement, if you place a date for it in 1968, Krishna Bandopadhyaya can write about it only in the 1990s, which is a good 30 years. And if you look at Malarika Sinha Roy's book on Naxalism, you will see how the concerns of the women who were part of the Naxalite struggle and the register in which Sharu Majumdar and others represent the women's question, there's an enormous gulf. The whole question of sexual violence is seen as the acme of feudal peasant culture by Sharu Majumdar, whereas for women it is of a very contiguous nature with landlessness, with not having control over common resources, with their bodies having to be transacted in that economy. Whereas for the men who led the Naxalite movement, that seemed the acme of feudal exploitation. There was a huge gulf between how women experienced and spoke about these matters and how progressive movements represented these matters to themselves and their cadres. And I think there's a lesson to be learned there for the simple reason that if we cannot bring up issues of intimate violence or harassment within progressive groups, is it any wonder that we cannot hold progressive academic male faculty to account? We cannot, because we have not queried these groups for their gender politics. We have not asked tough questions about sexual justice to these groups. We have not done that nearly enough. So today when young people put out a list, when Raya Sarkar puts out a list that reads like a who's who of Indian progressive academia, without sort of saying whether this is true or not, what is the register that we have to even begin a conversation on this subject? We don't have any, clearly. Because we have not sought to interrogate the radical tradition from a gender just perspective. And that's an important thing, for us to keep in mind, and that's something that you see in Manushi. There's a way in which everyone tries to talk about it and then falls back. There's a certain inarticulateness that sets in at that moment. So there's also the other thing, the language of the law becomes something of an anodyne. So everybody now, radical or otherwise, sort of climbs onto this bandwagon of the law. Which means that a whole bunch of other issues cannot be discussed. Caste and gender cannot be discussed in terms of the way they structure sexual violence. You cannot discuss sexuality in terms of the very insistent heteronormative realities that some of us may not want to be part of. You cannot discuss the domestic at all in any meaningful manner, except in terms of aberrant behavior or just something that's so terrible that, you know, it can only be exceptional, as with incest or with child rape. So there's a way in which the more stickier, tougher questions to do with how sexuality and intimacy are structured in our societies, even while they are being discussed in women's groups, even while we are listening to women's stories, never get translated into this conceptual register that goes to constitute Indian feminism, which is overdetermined by the law for the most part, and then overdetermined by theory of a very nebulous kind. So, and today I think, and this is why I sort of started with what I did, two movements have helped us rethink our theoretical positions. One is the queer movement, which has sort of pushed us to rethink the whole very vexed relationship between what we, in the olden days, used to call sex and gender. And how might we even retain those terms in any meaningful way? There's that. And very clearly, the queer movement has pointed to the fact that the question of sexual justice is not just a political question, it's also an ontological question. It has to do with the nature of being itself. What kind of a being are you if you don't want to identify as this or that? So the whole politics of being becomes very central to the way queer politics has positioned their critique of sex and gender. And Bahujan Dalit feminisms that have always existed, but which never sort of found theoretical expression outside the Ambedkarite or the Periyar movements. And even when they did, they drew on a vocabulary developed in the 1930s and 40s, which might not serve in exactly the same way in the 1970s or 1980s. So that tradition today has come into its own in very different circumstances, drawing on that tradition but also going on to say various other things. And they have drawn attention to the fact that you have to conceptualize the structuring of sexual subordination and violence in terms of the caste gender system. You can't escape doing that anymore. Now, it might come across in different ways. It might come across as a very baldly stated argument between Savarnas and Avarnas, or it might come across as, pass me the mic, you stop speaking for me. I think it comes across in diverse ways. But I think the anguish and the historical rightness of that question cannot be ignored. And I think in the women's movement, interestingly, and I'm sort of won't take too long, I think I have another 10 minutes to go, no? Yeah. The women's movement, interestingly, what has been our engagement with this range of issues? Because to come back to the present, to address some of these issues, what can we draw upon? And one thing is very clear, that we have been very uneasy with caste. We have not been able to engage with the caste question in a conceptual sense, though we might have and perhaps did in all contexts in an empirical sense. We would have taken cases to court, we would have attended caste panchayat meetings, we would have organized Dalit women, either through NGO collectives or through political movements. But how did we understand caste and gender? And I think there's been a lot of unease, and that unease is yet to be fully settled. And that unease can only get settled if we do a lot more fundamental groundwork in terms of how do we think about caste and gender in a larger context. And there's some work that's already been begun, but more work needs to be done, clearly, because caste also is not only a national question. The whole caste, the realities of caste are shaped by particular geographies and particular histories. So what might work in Rajasthan might not work in Kerala or in Bengal or in Tamil Nadu. And I think that's important also, because it seems that there is a universal Avarna-Savarna divide. And I think our histories are not so simple, our histories are not so linear. They're far more complex. So those histories also have to be taken on board when we think of that. But I think the women's movement, one can learn from working with difference, I think, has been in a very complex way with the queer movement, though I think there's much to be said on the side of, I'm sure queer people might not agree with my assessment of how the women's movement have addressed queerness, but I think it has done it slightly better than it has addressed caste. At least in terms of how it emerged in our various conferences, whether it was Tirupati or whether it was Ranchi or whether it was other conferences, there was a possibility of talking about queerness within a feminist space. Whereas with caste, it's always been a session allotted to Dalit and Adivasi women where they discuss their concerns, but the overall structuring of the conference is never in terms of this is a society which is sort of hinges on a caste gender axis. So there's that problem. But where I think very successfully women's groups and movements have engaged with difference while acknowledging that they can't accept the politics of a different group is with the communal question. And I think that's been a very productive engagement, especially in Western and Northern India and in Hyderabad, where women's groups have very successfully worked with Muslim groups, with minority groups, to address issues of gender justice in the context of riots, in the context of rehabilitation, while sort of keeping their views open on how communities handle the gender question, while being fully aware that communities have very diverse position on, say, triple talaq or on modified personal law and so on, it has been possible to engage with the communal question. Now, how did we manage that? That's a very interesting thing. I think part of it has to do with our self-perception. As urban feminists, many of us are comfortable with an unmarked secularism, which we inherit. If you don't think about God, you think you're secular. Or you're not engaged with religion in an everyday sense, it seems that the secular label is something you can adopt. And that secularism has been very productive. In a good feminist way, I think it's been very productive. And it has also led us to push our own understanding of sexual violence, like we did after the Gujarat violence. I mean, Saheli had this very important editorial in their newsletter saying, nothing of what we have done so far prepared us for this, for what we witnessed in Gujarat. And the continuous work that women's groups did on with Gujarat, that is something, or in Kandamal, for example, I think that is holds a lot of lessons and hope as to how there is no givenness about the women's groups and women's movements unable to engage with those who are not like them. So I think there is something to be learned there. Now, coming back to the present from here, so if you were to look at, say, the Raya Sarkar list, or if you were to look at, say, at the kinds of things that I listed at the beginning of my talk, a kind of openness to the kind of sexual lives we want for ourselves, an openness that's sort of getting twisted in very different ways. I mean, feminists have, after all, wanted sex work to be recognized as labor. Feminists have wanted the appellation sex work rather than prostitution. So the casualness with which transactional sex is discussed in universities is also part of that same historical moment, so to speak. But it comes from a very different position. It comes from a very corrupt university system. So basically then, how is it that some of our positions coexist with some extremely problematic positions, and how do we then make sense of that? So transactional sex and our demand for sex to be considered labor exist on the same plane, so to speak. And this is a reality we can't run away from. This is true. This is something that we are all aware of. Now, at a second level, like you see in Pollachi, we've talked and claimed women's sexual agency. And when women want to go out and date men, or women, without their families knowing, agree to meet some lad somewhere, and that lad tricks them into this terrible stuff that has happened in Pollachi, how do we make sense of that? By acknowledging that women are sexual beings who also want to flavor sexual experiences and sexual, want sexual love. So how do you talk about that at all? And these conversations have not been central to gender politics until the emergence of the queer movement. They may have existed within women's groups, but they didn't find a public register until the queer movement came along. So therefore, I think that conversation is very important to be had. The second thing is, what do we do with the whole Bahujan Dalit critique of caste and gender? And I think that critique, in the context of Me Too, at least to me, should be used to mount a fairly fundamental critique of higher education itself. So when Raya Sarkar's list puts forth a list of luminaries who are allegedly sexual predators, and then you have Rohit Vemula committing suicide, how do we join those dots? That's an important question. What is happening in our university spaces? Are Dalit Bahujan students made to feel welcome? What are the changes that have taken place in our curricular setup? How do classroom transactions happen? Do people feel comfortable in the course of those transactions? Are the realities that have so far been occluded from our syllabi brought in their fulsomeness into the classroom? Is an atmosphere there for Dalit Bahujan students to talk about things? So that is also a legitimate part of the Me Too debate, because some of the things that the young people are saying about these so-called sexual predators is they are not being responsible teachers. And how do you pin responsibility? Not simply on the basis of appropriate sexual behavior. It's also the kinds of models that we have built for ourselves. Who is a good teacher? Who is a progressive teacher? Who is a revolutionary teacher? Have we done enough to sort of deconstruct those categories and rethink them in some ways? So, and have we, and this, all of this has to happen at a time when the university system is in shambles, when funding is being withdrawn, when public universities are in crisis. So, therefore, I think if you bring a Bahujan Dalit critique to this whole Me Too movement, it would require us to join these many dots. Otherwise, what you end up with is, again, pushing everything into the domain of the law, which is a very unfortunate response that we had to the Raya Sarkar list. It's not so much that it was a generational debate, but that we sort of immediately retreated into the domain of the law. The law is certainly necessary and important, but I'm sure anyone who's ever been part of a women's group knows that the law is only one of the contexts in which we worked. It was never the most important context. It becomes the most important context because it allows you to talk about things in public which otherwise you cannot. For example, if there's a case of child rape, how do you even talk about it when the rapist is the father? How do you have a public conversation on that subject? And I'm sure some of you might remember that case with the undersecretary of the Home Department, that Sakshi case which set the protocols for how do you interrogate minors. I mean, how do you talk about that? This man is a senior bureaucrat. He's been consistently abusing his daughter. How do you even start a public conversation on that and the widespread nature of something like that? The law allows you to do some stuff like that. But beyond that, the law cannot do much because it will punish the individual. It's not going to kick off a public debate on the wider cultures within which these incidents happen. So I think, therefore, that the nature of the debates have to shift considerably beyond the law, while not giving up on the law. Because doing the law is hard work, it's thankless work, but as long as we are committed to some form of democratic reason, we have to stay committed to the law and the constitution. But they need not exhaust the ways in which we talk about these matters. And if you look at what the Raya Sarkar list does, actually it doesn't do anything that women's groups haven't done before. We have named and shamed in the past. When the case was going on in court, we've held meetings and called people names in public. We've held neighborhood meetings where we've tried to blackface the offenders. We've called their families to account. I mean, this is not something new. Naming and shaming is part of how we speak the unspeakable, or that which hasn't been spoken until now. And this faith in the law is something women's groups have been very ambiguous about. Barely or legal changes carried through. 10 years later, Flavia reviews 10 years of feminist legislation and says, this is not really working, is it? And Madhu Kishwar writes an editorial saying, I'm not sure that the law is going to give us all the answers. So again, this is not something that we need to sort of feel so tight about, which is where history becomes very useful to remind ourselves that some things are very, very specific to the moment, but other things are also part of a very larger culture of impunity that we are still fighting. That what was unspeakable in the 70s continues to be unspeakable in some ways, or can only be spoken of in certain ways. And how do you call into account very given aspects of our social lives, which is a family on the one hand, and if you are part of a progressive politics, the progressive movement on the other? How do you hold all these to account? What sort of impunity continues to shape these institutions? So these questions haven't gone away, I think. And there's something to be learned from what we did in the past, and a lot to be thought through from what we tried to do but didn't end up doing as perhaps we could have done. Without sort of flailing ourselves, how do we do this? And how do we have meaningful conversations with those who are part of the present moment and who are obviously interested in conversations beyond all the argument and the rancor? People are interested in conversations and people do want to listen to each other. And I think moving away from personalities or individuals or worrying about the fact of polarization, if we can bring in enough flesh and meat into this debate, which sort of show you that this is not such a simple issue, there's no linear history that we can narrate here, and sort of take in lessons from these two important developments in the field of sexuality politics, from the Dalit Bahujans and from queer activists and writers, then I think there are ways in which the past and the present can sort of sit together in a far more productive kind of way. Thank you very much.